Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the TV producer Anne Wood, the creator of Teletubbies, Rosie and Jim, and In the Night Garden. Growing up in a mining town in the northeast, there were scant children's books and no money to pay for them. She became a teacher and an early champion of children's literature. She says she's always had a knack for knowing what a three-year-old wants and has made big business out of tiny tots, creating candy-coloured worlds full of sunshine and soothing landscapes, populated by spongy characters that exchange gobbledygook greetings and chubby cuddles. It's a world away from the harsh insecurity that she has faced as a businesswoman. Early on, she put the family home up as collateral and then watched as TV companies made themselves millions from her ideas. No such problems these days. I felt I was being ripped off, she says. I started to go on business courses. I'm not going to be patronised whilst they take all the money. Reputedly, then, Anne Wood, total global Teletubbies-related sales have topped $1 billion, I read. Am I right?
To be honest, I couldn't tell you. I don't really know. It's possible that they have. My interest is really with how will a three-year-old view what I'm making. But it's very satisfying that it's making money, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be able to do the work. So one feeds the other.
You've said that of Teletubbies, it was an overnight success based on 35 years of experience.
That's true. And I think most overnight successes are based on a lot of experience. I first made a programme for very little children from nothing when I was at TVAM. And although the most famous thing that I did there was Roland Rat, of course, The thing that most interested me that I did there was Rubber Dub Tub. And it started with children in their pyjamas waving hello to what I imagined were other children in their pyjamas at the other end. And it worked brilliantly. And from then on, I thought there's an audience here that we could meet.
And when Teletubbies appeared on our screens, it was met with
horror.
Yes, horror. Yes, I'm glad you said that. It was genuine horror. There were headlines day to day. People were outraged. American preachers were blaming you for the downfall of Western civilization.
It was the most extraordinary experience, because I wanted to make a programme that had love in it, that was about big hugs. And you know, I had a wonderful writer in the shape of Andrew Davenport who had a great instinct for this. You'd thought I'd have started World War III, the response that happened. But there are people who are afraid of it for some reason. It's innocent fun. That's all it is.
Interesting that you spent much of your early career promoting children's literature and trying to get books into households that might not normally have books. People often see, you know, books in the good corner and children's TV in the bad corner. It's interesting that your career has, you know, has spanned both of them. Do you think people have a point that books in the end are much better for children than TV?
For me, you see, I believe that what matters is the child's imaginative development. The heart of a child is in their feelings and their imaginative capacity to make connections. And that's where true education comes from. It's the making connections. And stories connect. Stories connect. So stories, for me, have always been... I've just been passionately interested in stories. And I think children find stories exciting wherever and however they encounter them.
Let's have your first piece of music, then. And tell us what we're going to hear.
Well, I love Paul Robeson's songs, because in our household Paul Robeson was a great socialist hero, but I prefer to listen to Willard White now, because I feel the backgrounds to the old Robeson recordings are a bit sentimental, and one shouldn't sentimentalise a great man like Paul Robeson. So I want to listen to Willard White singing one of Paul Robeson's songs, Lazy Bones. I've always had to work, and my children always say that I always have to have a project, and I thought if I listen to Lazy Bones, perhaps I'll calm down a bit.
Lazy bones, sleeping in the sun, how you expect to get your day's work done? Never get your day's work done. sleeping in the shade.
That was Willard White and Lazy Bones. So knowing what children want, Anne Wood, there are entire global organisations devoted to that. You are somebody who thinks that instinctually you know what children want.
I know that I can watch what we've shot and instinctively edit like a three-year-old. So it's an editing capacity, I think, rather than knowing what they want.
So explain a little bit more. Can you unpick that a little for me? When you're sitting in an edit suite and you're watching...
Well, when I'm watching... I've made a great many programmes for children, and we have at Ragdoll a children's response unit so that we're in touch with watching children watch. It's very easy to do that these days.
How do you do it?
We leave a little DV camera on top of the television, and obviously with the permission of the parents, and it's all very properly done.
And is this in their home?
In their homes.
Right.
It's not a focus group.
Right.
You know, because most people say, oh, it's a focus group. No, no, it is not. There's all the difference between a response and an answer. It's a question of observing what holds attention and what makes them smile.
It was interesting to hear you talk about your writer and what a brilliant writer he was, because some people worry about the characters making sounds, not words. The uh-oh and the la-la and all that sort of stuff.
Well, Andrew, the writer, has a degree in speech sciences anyway, so he understood about emergent speech. And also a lot of people really overlook the fact that children are thinking from the minute they're born. You know, they're thinking before they can articulate what they're thinking. I once had the experience of an American commissioning editor saying to me, but how will the children know what to do if no one tells them? And I thought, I will never be able to sell you a programme, because if you think like that, you know, if you don't trust that a child has instinctive responses to the world that are to be encouraged and developed from the inside, you won't ever understand what I'm trying to do here. So I had to give up on that lady.
Might that be, though, quite an idealistic interpretation of childhood? I mean, if you're a very engaged parent, and if you're also doing all the stuff with the books and taking them to the odd music class here and there, and making the pasta shapes for half an hour every day with the glue and so on, then that's all fine if it's part of their experience. But for so many children now, of course, it is their experience of life at home, is sitting in front of the TV, and hence we have little children turning up at school that don't have much of a vocabulary, that are not able to communicate their thoughts in a coherent sentence, and so on. Do you think that television is an important part of that problem?
I think television is really important for children who don't have anything else, because through television we can give them so much if we make the kinds of programmes that encourage that imaginative connection. I don't think you can ever say that children, if they didn't have television, would have speech if they're coming from the kind of household that gives them nothing. It's not the television that does it. It's the circumstances in which the child is growing up.
But
it's
what then
too
about...
easy to make television a scapegoat, which people want to do. It's easy way out.
Right, but a lot of teachers, especially teachers with plenty teaching experience over the decades, will say that anecdotally they notice many more children now turning up in nursery or in a preschool class with much less of an ability to articulate themselves than was, say, the case 20, 25 years ago.
Yes, this may be true, but this may be because the parent has the opportunity not to talk to the child because of the fact that they can put the television on. But that is not to say that television per se is the problem. The whole circumstance of parenthood and family life has changed from 25 years ago. You know, people aren't there as much. Mothers work because they have to. I'm not saying mothers shouldn't work. Heavens, I've worked. But I think, you know, to say that and to say, well, then television must be the problem, is far too facile an answer.
Let's have some more music then, Anne Wood. What's next?
Oh, well, Dance with a Dolly is a very rare piece, because my mother, who was not very articulate, my father was the great talker in the family, but my mother was the one who would be silly occasionally. It's hard for me to remember because she developed multiple sclerosis in later life. But when I was little, she would sing this song to me and her whole body would shake with it, and we would have a lot of fun. And I do this with my grandchildren now, so it's very special to me.
I want to dance with a dolly with a hole in the stocking, while her knees keep a knocking and her toes keep a rocking. Going to dance with a dolly with a hole in the stocking, going to dance by the light of the moon. Cause my little dolly has her boots made of leather and she's light as a feather when we're dancing together. Yes, my little dolly has her boots made of leather when we dance by the light of the moon. Mama, mama, gonna go out
tonight. Go out tonight. Go out tonight. Mama, mama, gonna go out tonight. Gonna dance by the light of the moon.
That was Clinton Ford and Dance with a Dolly. So, Anne, would these worlds, these candy-coloured worlds full of sunshine and light and smooth rolling landscapes, are not the memories of your childhood? Tell me about, you were born in 1937.
Yes, I was born in 1937 in Spennymoor in County Durham. And we moved then to a place called Tudor Colliery, which when I was very little, which was just outside.
And what was it like?
Well, the pits were working. There was very little in the way of entertainment apart from what happened in the house. Lots of, you know, singing around the piano and everything happened. My earliest memories are of the blackout and everything being rather dark. I've always had a great love of gardens and flowers and all things that have colour. So I suppose I've always yearned for colour. Maybe that's deep in my psyche. My house is full of colour.
Your hair is full of colour.
That's true.
What have we got in there? We've got some pink
and should be
and
white.
And
it should be white, and it's got red and brown and all sorts of colours in it.
Looks wonderful.
Thank you.
And so is that's why we see a lot of gardens, is it, in your stuff? Because, of course, looking at the flowers, smelling the flowers, you know, that's a prominent part.
It could be. I mean, I wasn't aware of that, but yes, it might be. Certainly in the night garden, it was influenced by it, for sure.
You said earlier that, you know, the children's world really is what's happening on the inside, not what's happening on the outside. So although it was a world of blackout blinds and darkness and the pits were nearby. It was a happy world, was it?
It was a relatively happy world. I mean, I grew up with my grandmother. My mother worked in a munitions factory and my father was in the Royal Marines, so and I was an only child by accident rather than design. And I grew up very close to my grandmother, who had a very difficult life in that her husband died down the pit and she was left with 6 children and one still to be born, and she had to bring those children up without any support. So she was quite strict with me and we used to have some quite fun times, but she was lovely. I kind of had a 20s childhood,
right.
You know, in the way that I was brought up rather than a 30s childhood, perhaps.
And you yourself had siblings that died in infancy, is that right?
Yes, well, there would have been brothers, but I'm afraid they died when they were babies. And my poor mother was, I mean, again, it wasn't an uncommon thing.
Indeed, infant mortality levels
were very high. And there wasn't the care that there is now.
Was it something that your mother spoke about or not?
Nobody ever spoke about it. I learned about it later. It was always there, unspoken, in a way. But I was in my teens before I really understood.
And then did it mean that you were you particularly cosseted as a child?
I wasn't cosseted because of my grandmother.
Right.
And also because I was very lucky. In the community where I grew up, everybody played outside and the entire community looked after all the children. So if you strayed too far at the end of the street, somebody would come out and say, "You get back down home, shouldn't be here." And used to go. So I took my chance along with everybody else's child outside and did all kinds of things that I'd blench if I thought my grandchildren were doing them.
Let's have some more music then, Anne. Disc number 3. Why have you chosen this and what is it?
Well, the one thing that we had in our village was a Methodist chapel, which was just across the road from where we lived. And my father was a Methodist preacher. So the chapel was where I went, and that was at a sort of social point of our village. So if you've been brought up like that, you still remember the hymns. But I thought this would capture the atmosphere, really, of the chapel-going days.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
Alison Krauss and Down to the River to Pray from the soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Anne, you would have been around about 8 when your father came home from war?
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes. Oh, I remember that. Absolutely.
Tell me about it.
Well, because we used to have the shed in the backyard to play in, and when he came back, we couldn't have it anymore. and I wrote him a letter of complaint, which became a family exhibit, I remember.
So you were quite a feisty, articulate young child, were you?
I was, I'm afraid, yes.
And what about, I got the impression from everything that I've read about you that there wasn't a lot of spare cash around, typical of all your neighbours, I imagine, too.
No, we lived in a very poor community. Nobody had any money. Nobody had any money. The first time I became really aware of it was when I went to the grammar school and everyone else could go on the trip to France and I couldn't. And I suddenly thought, now there's a difference.
You can be, as a child, angry about that. You can feel ashamed. You can feel annoyed with your parents. What did you feel?
I just felt disappointment. I didn't feel angry with my parents. I understood why I couldn't go. And it was hugely disappointing. But, you know, you just got on with it. I never felt angry with them. They were wonderful parents.
Did it fire your ambition, do you think?
I don't know. You see, the trouble is, when you grew up as a woman in the Northeast, I was always aware that there was a conflict between what I felt I ought to be able to do and what was considered possible for me to do.
How interesting.
There was a lack of aspiration. And I think, to an extent, there still is. Because it is a very depressed area. And my parents themselves had been so disappointed in life. I mean, they were wonderfully joyous people, but they had had many, many disappointments in their lives. And they had accepted that there was no possibilities beyond for them.
And so this poverty of aspiration, you were a smart enough girl to go to a grammar school. Presumably at grammar school they did open your eyes to all sorts of possibilities.
At grammar school, the boys were always favoured. The school I went to, it was a mixed grammar school. And so there was still a degree in the 1940s, 50s of chauvinism up there. Andy Capp lives, you know.
And what about books in the house? There weren't books
there
in the house?
There was the Bible. There were magazines. The magazines my grandmother read. There were things like John Bull, Picture Post, that my father got. But there was no range of novels or, you know, they hadn't, you know, we didn't have a complete set of Dickens or anything, which some houses did. And there was no library locally.
Right. So you were only reading at school.
So but when I went to grammar school, of course, then you could read. Then it was a world opened up.
Let's have some more music then. What's next?
Now, one of the things that did happen when I was at grammar school in the 40s, the Arts Council was just getting underway again. You know, it's hard to remember that it was late 40s after the war. And they sent an opera group, and it was, I think, four singers and a piano. And they came and performed Così fan tutti at Spennymoor Town Hall. And it was the most eye-opening experience for me. I had never imagined anything like this.
Suavisi il vento, may the wind be gentle, from Mozart's Così fan tutti, with Carol Van Ness, Deborah Siegler and Claudio Desdari, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Bernard Haitink. You are then, Anne Wood, in your early 70s now, and you say that in spite of your family's protestations, you feel the need to keep going, to keep working. I'm wondering if, as a young girl at grammar school, you were very industrious.
We all worked hard. The capacity to work hard, I think, is built into the northeastern psyche. I mean, but yes, I did. I was terribly conscientious. But I actually became very interested in studying. My mother was a bit horrified, and she'd say to my father things. I don't know where she gets her ideas from. But he'd go, from books, woman, from books. he was bookish and very proud of the fact that I did well. But for my mother, it was a bafflement. Really.
Yes, did that give you a sort of sense of kind of separation, if you like, from your mother, that she was a certain type of person and you seemed to be quite another?
Yes, there was that. I mean, I loved my mother deeply, but you know, my poor mother, you know, she'd had five pregnancies and lost children, and she ended up with me. And, you know, it must have been quite hard for her. I think she sensed I would leave home.
Right. And what age did you leave home at?
I went to college at 18 and I left home at 21.
And you were studying to be a teacher?
I studied, yes, because that's what you did. You know, if you didn't want to be a nurse, you became a teacher.
Yes, that's very interesting. I wanted to ask you that, and I don't mean it to be in any way insulting, but I'm wondering if it was just that's what you did more than you had a desire to teach.
I think that I probably did want to become a teacher, but there wasn't really any other option offered up to me, because university, one was very aware that socially it was a different world and it would cost more money to stay there longer. And I didn't feel that I was perhaps strong enough to go in myself.
And teaching, you did go and teach, obviously.
I did go and teach, and yes. I enjoyed it very much, because I really love recognising, if I can, I mean, that sounds terribly pompous, but if you see a potential in a child and you can in some way encourage it to come out, it's a lovely thing to do.
And were you one of those teachers, I mean, because none of your former pupils are here, you know, I only have your word for it, but do you think you were one of those teachers who helped to open people's eyes to a love of literature who might not otherwise have had their eyes opened?
I'd like to think so. I mean, when Teletubbies hit the headlines, many of my old pupils wrote to me, and one girl wrote and said, you know, you changed my brother's life, he learned to love books. So I suppose I had one success. I'd like to think there were more than one.
And were you an unconventional teacher? I ask that because you seem to me to be quite an unconventional woman. So do you think when you were in the school, people sort of thought of you as, well, you know, that Anne Wood, she's a bit of an oddball?
Yes, they did, I think, probably. I would do things that were perhaps not the easiest.
Right.
But you see, what you have to remember is that was the 60s. Unconventionality and all of that in the 60s was encouraged. So we had fun in the 60s.
Let's have some music, Anne. Would you tell me about what we're going to hear next?
Oh, well, this is for my lovely husband. 53 years ago or more, we used to listen to Buddy Holly, and this song is just as true today as it was then. And there is a really romantic thing to say, but it's true.
Sometimes we'll sigh, sometimes we'll cry, and we'll know why, just you and I know true love was.
That was Buddy Holly and True Love Ways. I was wondering, listening to that, Anne, there was your husband Barry, 53 years ago, who married this young teacher from the Northeast, and here he is now, all these years later, married to this sort of supercharged telly bigwig who makes headlines. And I think, you know, by dint of your reputation, is a woman to be reckoned with within the field of television. How has he felt about that journey?
Well, I think you'd have to ask him, but he loves
me. I'm sure he's told
you. He loves me. As I am.
But do you ever look at each other and say, well, who would have thought?
No, we don't look at each other and think who would have thought, because I'm always, it's just at home, we're at home, and it's hard work. And he's a Yorkshireman. You know, one should be warned about marrying Yorkshireman. So he's still the same. He still worries about money. It hasn't really changed him, and I think that's why we still love each other.
Right. You say he worries about money, and I said in the introduction that at one point you put your house up as collateral when you were beginning Ragdoll Productions.
Yeah.
So how did that conversation
go?
Well,
he has been wonderful about it. We had at that time got two children in further education, and I had to work, and he trusted me to do it. I mean, I think he must always have believed in me, but I'm also very stubborn, so it might have broken up if I don't know, but either way, we did it.
When you say you might have broken up, you're not talking there about Ragdoll Productions, you're talking about in the marriage.
Yes, in the marriage,
okay.
Yes. I mean, if I hadn't been able to do this, I have this real need to do this work, you know, and he knows that and he respects that.
You had taken some time off work when your children were younger. You stopped teaching and you were a full-time mum.
Well, I was a full-time mum, but I always worked. In order to keep, you know, earning my bread, I gave lectures at an adult education institute in the evenings about children's literature. And we set up a children's book group, because I found when I had my first child that you got a lot of advice about this is how you bath a baby, this is how you do this, this is how you do that. Nobody ever said, do you ever sing to your baby? Or, you know, do you do finger rhymes? You know. So we started this little magazine called Books for Your Children, which I ran for 30 years, actually. And that, in turn, led to an organisation called the Federation of Children's Book Groups. So I did that for 30 years, even after I'd started to work in television.
What about, do you think the pendulum has swung maybe too far in the other direction, where when you have a child now, you know, it's the baby Einstein videos, and it's the mobile above the cot that will stimulate their thought processes and enable them to be, you know, a wizard at Mandarin Chinese by the time they're four. We seem to be rather preoccupied these days with, you know, connecting with our children at an intellectual level at a very young age.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, there is an awful lot of anxiety being generated, which I think is a terrible thing. What I was talking about was just, you know, enjoying innocent fun, really, having a sing and playing round the garden. I don't like the name Baby Einstein. The idea that there's only one way for a child to be intellectually developed is anathema to me, so I hate that. And I think it's, again, you know, making money out of people's anxieties, which is a shame.
Are you something of a celebrity grandma? Do you get sort of trooped around the playground, and does you one of your granddaughters is six, and my grandma made up Teletubbies?
No, there is none of that. I don't live close enough to my grandchildren to be trooped around the playground or anything. All I can tell you is that I did an English adaptation of The Moomins years ago, which our son showed to our granddaughter, and she said, is this Disney, Daddy? And he said, no, it's Grandma. You know, well, I don't want to watch it then.
Very grounding. Yeah. Right, some more music then. What's next? We're on disc six.
This is the Vivaldi Gloria. There are moments in life, I find, when if you've got twilight in the garden and you've had a really good gardening day and you're looking across at something that's really lovely, words cannot express what you feel. And this, for me, expresses what you feel. You know, you feel there must be a God. So this is for those moments.
Domini Fili Unigenite from Vivaldi's Gloria, with the new Philharmonia Chorus and Orchestra conducted by Riccardo Muti. You've won a huge number of awards, Anne Wood. You've won BAFTAs for Teletubbies and for In the Night Garden, as well as knowing that lots of people, tens of millions of people, watch the programmes and they make good money for your company. Is it important that you get the artistic recognition?
I think it's very important for children's television that there is artistic recognition, because it's so often not recognised as an artistic medium. And one always feels that they really are on behalf of everybody who works with you, because it's a collaborative process, ours.
Let's talk about the moment then when you thought, you felt indeed, that you were being taken for a ride by the big TV companies. There you were, making product that was your idea, that was generated by the team that you'd put your life and soul into, that indeed you'd put your house on the line for, to start Ragdoll Productions. And there are the TV companies making a nice fat buck
yes,
from it.
Yes, well, it does sound hard where you put it, but what happened was, and what changed children's television, was when the video market opened up.
Right.
When the video market happened, which coincided with Rosie and Jim, two genre made money, films and children's programmes. So they started to make a great deal of money. And the company that I made Rosie and Jim for chose not to share any of that with us. And my whole northeastern soul rose up in protest and thought, this is not fair.
So you decided that you wanted to get your business head screwed on. And what did you do? You went on courses?
I went on courses. I had business advisors in. But what it comes down to, you know, is you have to learn when to compromise. And also then you have to learn when not to compromise. I've always been very lucky in that what's driven me has been this need to connect with the imaginative life of children. I don't know where that comes from or why, or whether it was just an escape from the rather limiting circumstances of my childhood in many ways. Perhaps it's that. But anyway, that I will fight for. And if I have to make money in order to go on making the programmes, then that's what I have to do.
But you must enjoy making the money, isn't it?
I do. Yes. I do enjoy making the money because it's very satisfying, because everyone treats you differently. You know, this whole idea that you can only make a contribution if you're rich is what seems to govern our society. It's just how things are.
Let's have some more music then, Anne. We're on disc seven.
Disc seven is from the Imagine Project by Herbie Hancock's I Love Jazz. But I chose this because 15% of our company is owned by the Ragdoll Foundation, which is dedicated to listening to the imaginative needs of children. And one of the projects we're working on at the moment is something that we set up with Save the Children some years ago, where we're making films with children in less economically developed parts of the world. And however poor their circumstances, they always have a story to tell. So it matters to me, the imagining, very much.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky.
That was Imagine with Seal and Pink from Herbie Hancock and the Imagine Project. Anne Woods, as I've said, you're in your 73, to be specific.
I am, yes.
Yes. No sign of retirement?
Well, no, because I am very fortunate in that I'm working with my son and I don't do anything other than the creative bits now.
Quite nice, actually.
Lovely. I'm so lucky. No, I'm so lucky.
And what about being comfortable with the affluence that your success has brought? I mean, Billy Connolly says, you know, there's a point at which he just can't spend a certain amount of money on something because of where he comes from.
Well, I think the idea that I am personally wealthy is hugely exaggerated, because the money is in the company being used, you know, so I don't have... I'm not saying that I'm poor or anything like that, but I don't have huge amounts of money. But what I have been able to do that I've loved doing, and my great indulgence is my garden. I've been able to make a garden from nothing, and I spend far too much money on it still, and I couldn't have done that. I would never have done that had I not had the success I've had.
It's ridiculous. I'm picturing you, of course, in the night garden. Does it look anything like that?
No, it doesn't look anything like the night garden, but it's a very interesting garden in that it's got a little meadow and it's got a little bit of a tiny bit of woodland with a stream going through it, and I love it.
So you've got grandchildren now, you've had this very, very long marriage, 53 years, very successful career. Life on an island for you, would it mean a lot of loneliness, or would you quite like sort of breathing out and taking some time to yourself?
Oh, I'd be terribly lonely. I need people, so I'd have to have a project to do. I'd have to think of something to do.
Right, tell us about the final piece we're going to hear then, Anne Wood. What is it?
The final piece is Hugh Laurie's version of St. James Infirmary, because I thought and thought and thought about, you know, which New Orleans-type jazz would I have, because I do love it so much, because it's so deeply emotional. And then I got so interested in the fact that there was he from Oxfordshire, able to play jazz piano and express this same emotion. And I really admire that. I'd love to have been able to play jazz piano, so I'd like that.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so fair.
That was Hugh Laurie and St. James Infirmary. So, Anne, this is the point where I give you the books. They're going to be the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And you get to take a book along with you as well. What would you like to take?
Well, I thought about this a lot, but then I thought, well, if you've got the Bible, the King James Version, and the whole of Shakespeare, including the sonnets, really, you know, you don't want any more serious reading. And so I thought I'll go for guilty pleasure. And I discovered the romantic novels of Georgette Heyer when I was 12. And all through my life, in times of stress and sickness and illness and everything else, they've been a great resource as an escape. So I thought my emotional escape will be Cotillion by Georgette Heyer.
Right, that's yours. And a luxury too.
The luxury, well, it would have to relate to gardening, but I thought, well, I could maybe improvise, you know, a garden. But what would be lovely to have as a project, which I have to have, is if I could make a florilegium of all of the plants that might be growing. Let's hope there are some. So I'd need paper and pens and watercolours and anything that I can record the life of plants on the island.
You can certainly have that. And if you had to save just one of these 8 discs, which one would you save?
I think it would have to be the Vivaldi, just because it is so life-affirming, and you'd need that from time to time.
It's yours. Anne Wood, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.